Connecticut Today, back at it for you, Tuesday, August 25th. We gave you portions of a coronavirus update from Danbury. Governor Ned Lamont joined by several local officials, including Danbury Mayor Mark Mountain. Professor Alan Sanders, one of our go-to guys, former Time Magazine correspondent, gave us his perspective of both the Democratic and Republican national conventions. And our buddy Tom Dudchick joined us in the 5 o'clock hour from the Capitol Report on News 8 and also ctcapitalreport.com. Online, Tom giving us his outlook on all the latest political scuttlebutt in Connecticut. And on the show numerous times, Professor Alan Sanders, former Time Magazine reporter, who until just this year taught political science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey. Professor Paul here at WICC in Bridgeport once again. Hope you are well. How are you?
I'm doing great, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm good. All good. Socially great. Distant and all that, and trying to make any sense of what we see here. Did you ever, in all your years of covering politics for Time, or teaching students, trying to show them the American political process or make sense of it, did you ever think we would be looking at 2 weeks of what we're looking at right now?
No, never. And obviously neither did the politician. it's quite unusual, and it's causing all kinds of adaptations and all kinds of changes and all kinds of unpredictabilities. But I must say that given all that, I think both parties are doing the best that they can. That's looking at it technically, not looking at it in terms of the policies that they're espousing. But they've adapted reasonably well. But I think that, if we get past this pandemic, and I certainly hope we do, I think they'll both parties will be eager to get back to the traditional convention, because politics is a people-to-people, a person-to-person kind of activity, and it's hard to really do that well through the virtual medium.
Yeah, and even though we know, Professor, that these things have become pretty much pep rallies, I don't think we've had any really intrigue. I think you have to go back to 1980 with the Democrats and Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy, and maybe 76, with Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan. I mean, these are glorified pep rallies. We know that, and you're right. There's no crowds. There's no cheering. There's no, when they call for the votes, Connecticut, the state of this, or Virginia, the great state of Virginia. I know they're trying to do that cyber-wise. And Professor, there's no balloon drop. It really is somewhat sterile. But yet, I've seen the TV numbers, and a lot of people are still watching.
Yes, because everybody's interested in this election. This is a very important election. There are really two different paths that are being set forth by the two parties, more clear-cut than in any recent elections. And so I think people are quite interested in hearing where the where each side wants to go. Now, most people know where each side wants to go, despite the exaggerations. I think most voters are quite aware of what the Democrats really want to do, and most people are quite aware of what the Republicans really want to do. A lot of politics is cheerleading, as you pointed out. And so what these conventions, virtual as well as real, do is one of their basic functions, and one should not underestimate that, is to activate the activists and to try and convince those who are convincible. So they're entirely predictable in terms of what is going to happen, but it's important to activate people. And then one other thing that I want to indicate to you about the traditional conventions, which is harder to do now conventionally. Conventions are more than what is shown on television. There's a lot of activity that occurs in the daytime beyond the cameras. Lots of fundraising goes on. Many of the down-ballot candidates look to conventions in order to meet donors, in order to meet activists, in order to energize their own races, which are down-ballot, senators, congressmen, governors, and even state legislators and county executives. So that's very important, and it's hard to do when you're doing it virtually. So conventions are extremely important, and that's why I think we'll go back to a more traditional format once the pandemic gets past us.
Professor, hang on. We'll be right back with more. Professor Alan Sanders, former Time Magazine reporter and taught political science for many years at St. Peter's University in Jersey City. Professor, hang on. Traffic and weather together, 4:36 on WICC. A few more minutes with Professor Alan Sanders, former Time magazine reporter, who until this year taught political science for years at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey, well-renowned and sought-after media expert on politics. Professor, one thing that you talked about not seeing this year, which usually is a subtopic that gets a little bit of intrigue, especially for folks like you and I that are into this, and correct me if I missed it, I haven't seen anything, but we usually hear about platforms and about maybe platform fights, you know, okay, you add this to the platform, but I get to take this out. We're really not getting much of that this year, are we?
No, we're not. And it's quite interesting, actually. Of course, one of the reasons you're not hearing much about it is that the candidates typically ignore the platform. It's not so much a platform for the candidate to campaign on. It's more of a statement about the relative strength of the various factions within a party and which faction seems to be in ascendance, which faction didn't make it, so to speak, on certain policies. So it's really more of an internal kind of a document, which gives you the temperature of where the party is. What's interesting is that the Democrats did produce a platform. Now, you haven't heard much about it, obviously, because, again, it's an internal document for the most part these days. But they did produce a platform. What's interesting is that the Republicans did not. And that's indicative of two things. One, I think there's a real strain between various factions of the parties, strains that have been sort of stomped upon by Donald Trump, which is kind of a big gorilla, and, you know, he kind of stomps out any kind of dissent. But nonetheless, it's a statement about the fact that post-Trump, there may be a real internal fight within the party. And secondly, it is a statement about Trump himself. Many people have said that he really doesn't have any consistent policy. It's just whatever impulses of the moment he believes will be good for the country and also be good for Donald Trump. So it's kind of interesting that the Democrats do have a platform going into this election, but the Republicans do not.
Let's talk about, in the minutes we have left, the messages of both candidates. I thought Joe Biden did a good job with his speech last week, and I talked earlier in the show, Professor, before you came on, about how, and having, you know, interviewed speechwriters over the years, several of them, these speeches are worked on for weeks and sometimes months when they know they have to be delivered. Words have meanings in this speech. And Joe Biden, you're right, there wasn't so much policy mention as the allusions were to heart and soul of a country and doing the right thing. So it was kind of a little bit, correct me if I'm wrong, like a velvet hammer making this about Donald Trump. Did you think that?
Yes, certainly that's the strategy that is going forward on the Biden campaign. But it's also a little deeper than that, in my view. For the Democrats, for Joe Biden, character and integrity is not just a personal quality. They're making it into a policy matter. That is to say, to have a convincing policy, to have a convincing set of actions with all the problems that the country is now facing, you need a president who has empathy, who has integrity, who can listen, and who can adapt to the facts and to the science. And so in this particular election, what's interesting is they're turning character and integrity and competence into policy, into a policy statement. And I find that very interesting. We'll have to see whether it's successful. On the Republican side, what's also interesting to me is that if you cut through all the rhetoric that we, and some of it was quite hyperbolic last night, but if you cut through all the rhetoric of the Republican speakers and Donald Trump, his case is basically saying, I'm not the other guy. Now, typically, that's not a winning campaign strategy. I mean, you certainly have to say, I'm not the other guy, or I'm not the other candidate, but you also have to have a set of policy proposals. And so far at this convention, all we've really heard is, I'm not the other guy. So the next question then is, so what are you for? And we'll have to see whether the next few nights give us an answer to that question.
And I thought it interesting in the speech by the Cuban gentleman who came over to the U.S. and is thriving here, Tim Scott, the only black Republican Senate member. I think the title of his speech was something like From Cotton to Congress, which is kind of mm-hmm. cute, I thought. And then Nikki Haley, who, you know, has a bright future in the Republican Party. It does seem like the overall message of the party, too, is like, hey, this is who we really are. the other guys don't really kind of believe in, you know, they kind of frame it as the goodness of America. Yeah, they harp on everything that's bad, but there's still a lot of really darn good things about this country.
Right. And what was really interesting is you had, you know, Kimberly Guilfoy and Donald Trump Jr. sort of, you know, beating the drums and with all kinds of hyperbolic language. And you had Nikki Haley and Senator Scott really giving a much softer version. And so what you really saw here is the internal conflict that the GOP will face in a post-Trump era whenever that occurs. You'll have the strong supporters of the Trump view of the world, but you have these more mainstream Republicans who are trying to make the case for going in a slightly different direction once the Trump presidency ends, whenever it does. So it was kind of interesting to watch that. I think that was a preview of the kind of conflict that you'll see post-Trump.
Final question, Professor. You were a reporter, obviously, for many years. You covered administrations. You covered D.C. I find it interesting, and despite the fact that I do basically this opinionated show, I was a credentialed journalist for years. I have a journalism degree. I'm wondering how much exposure they're going to give Joe Biden to reporters. I guess that has to do maybe with what the polls are showing. You know, Mr. Biden is still doing these kind of one-on-one video interviews, but I'm wondering if he will be forced to, at any time in the next 2 months, actually hold, you know, the free-form, free-for-all news conferences, you know, getting peppered with all different questions, and people say, well, can he really do that? I think that's a really interesting twist here.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I think you'll see that if they come to the conclusion that Biden is, you know, going down in the polls, or that the campaign is losing some of its momentum. Right now, it doesn't seem to, because what's really interesting is that, you know, Joe Biden has accidentally stumbled on this strategy. That is to say, you know, he is a politician. He loves to shake hands and embrace people, but the pandemic forced him to do this, and to his great surprise, it has worked. And so if something works, you don't change it unless there's reason to do so. And so far, there are no signs that, you know, there's any imperative to do that.
What about the thought of Kamala Harris here? And briefly, there's all this thinking that, well, Joe Biden is not going to be able to make it to a full term. Does she really have an effect on this race? We always tend to wax poetic about, you know, what will vice presidential candidates do. Is this year that different with her or not?
Well, I think it is different in the sense that, you know, she brings a younger tone, a younger face, a younger perspective to the Biden, candidacy. And that's important to activate young voters. It's all about activating that, you know, 1% somewhere that will make a difference between a win and a loss. So I'm one of those who believes that overall the vice president doesn't change the trajectory necessarily, but can affect individual close races in certain states. It also is important for the down ballot candidates. The vice president can bring enthusiasm to that, to some of those races. So I do think it's important, and I think it's particularly important today within the Democratic Party, not necessarily to convince Republicans or independents, but to convince Democrats that they actually have an exciting ticket, a ticket that is worth going out and campaign most heartily for.
Professor, as always, fascinating, former Time magazine reporter who until this year taught political science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey, published author as well, Professor Alan Sanders. Professor, thank you. We'll be in touch. We appreciate it.
All right. My pleasure, Paul. Take care.
Thanks. Thanks, Professor. We appreciate it. All right. Good stuff there. 4:48, a little late, traffic and weather together, and then top of the hour news coming up straight ahead right here on Connecticut Today.
Phone all weekend long, addressing some of the concerns that we've had. One of the deepest concerns I think that we both share is that we see some of the spread going on amongst our children, and that's concerning to parents, to grandparents, to loved ones. We want to make sure that we can slow the spread, and we really only have about a week and a half to do that. Once a week and a half goes by, if you haven't taken the right steps, if you haven't done the right things, it can be a runaway freight train, and that's why we're here today. We want everybody to get tested. We're offering testing today, right now at Rogers Park Middle School till 2 p.m. and then again starting at 4:30 p.m. And we've had almost 1,000 people that have been tested over the last 2 days. So Danbury residents, go out there. You don't need to be symptomatic. It's a free test. And that way we can find the levels of the spread and where it is, and you, through our contact tracing, be able to go back and be able to find out where folks picked up the particular virus. With that, I want to call the governor up now for some remarks, and once again, just thank him for making all the resources available to the state. Governor?
All right. Hey, well, thank you, Mark. And we were just standing there, remember, March 6th. It seems like yesterday when at Danbury Hospital, with the very first infection was right here, not that long ago. Remember, we used to think Wuhan is a long way away, and then it was Seattle, and then it was New Rochelle, and that one is Connecticut, and that was here. A lot has gone on since then. We had our surge, there's no question about it, and Danbury Hospital, a lot of our hospitals got closed, but always had capacity, you know, for which we're very thankful. And really, over the last few months, as we've cautiously reopened the state, our infection rate has consistently gone down. So we're really been one of the lowest in the country, about 1% over the last, 60, 70, 80 days, for which we're really thankful. And that was really due to prevention, because of everybody really following the protocol seriously, starting with a mask, keeping the social distancing. But there have been leaks. And it's a little ironic that here we are back in Danbury, because we've had, it's not a surge, but it's an uptick. And we're going to come down hard on upticks like this. We've had maybe 1% infection rate around the state, and maybe 6 or 7% here in Danbury. And it happened relatively quickly. And, Mayor, that's why we've come in hard. You know, thanks to your leadership here, we've come in hard. We've come in hard with testing in particular, testing and track and trace. We've tested hundreds of people in here. And I got to say, everything I've heard from public health is that the people of Danbury have been just great. They've come in, they've taken their tests, they've waited in terms of those results. I did hear, look, we got to do an even better job of getting those results faster. You know, we've got most of the state now, we get the results back in a day or two, but imagine how many extra people you can talk to if it takes 5 days to get those results. We are gonna prioritize Danbury in terms of making sure we get those results back, so we can track and trace, so we can limit the spread. You know, right now it's not spreading beyond the greater beyond Danbury, to be more specific, for which we're really thankful. Really thankful the community here taking the quarantining seriously when we've got to do that. With one, I guess, a bit of an exception. You were telling me about some of the parties, maybe in Candlewood Lake. So we've had to shut down the boat launch there. I think the mayor's done the same right now. Chief of Staff was telling me, you know, it was getting sort of, you almost had the Uber of boats going back and forth to the island, and maybe 100 plus kids out there. And again, we've seen a higher infection rate among young people. And just remember, young people, perhaps you don't suffer all the same complications that your parents or grandparents do, but you can infect. And I got to be very strict about this. The mayor's being incredibly strict about this, and we're going to hold people accountable. And you're not going to be going out for these big parties going forward. Look, it's going to be a bit of a journey, and it's not going to be a straight line. And I think you know that nobody more than me wanted to get our schools open. I knew just how important that is for young people, especially the kids who've been social isolated for so long. But I think Danbury's doing the right thing. We're going to hold off on in-person education for at least till October 1st, is that right? But we're gonna have a green light or have a determination over the next few weeks. I know Western Connecticut as well had to slow that down. Look, the rest of the state's at 1%. They're in a different situation. But when you have to change course, public health comes first. That's what we're doing in Danbury. And I just gotta say to all the healthcare team that's here, you guys have been amazing. You were here at the very beginning when we were here. I'm pleased to see that you, I think you mentioned there may be 4 or 5 folks in the ICU maximum. We've got good capacity in our hospitals now. This is not a time to panic, but it is a time to be cautious. And remember, if we hit this hard here in Danbury, it doesn't spread beyond. We can continue to make good progress across the state. Thanks, everybody.
I'd like to take a quick moment to recognize our emergency management team that's here with us. Matt Casavecchia from New Vance, who's the incoming emergency management director, and TJ Weedle, who is our current emergency management director, who is hanging on. until I tell him he's done. That's going to be a while. We also have a great legislative delegation that's been very supportive, and I'm going to ask David Arcani, state representative from the Fighting 109th District, to come forward with a few thoughts. David?
Thanks, everybody. And, you know, I'm really going to speak today as my role as House Chair of the Energy Committee as well. Acting Director Kara Prunty gave us a great detailed update on where we're seeing the spikes here in Danbury and some of the reasons for it a little earlier. And there's a noticeable uptick in infections within neighborhoods, within parts of our city that were without power for the longest. The areas of downtown in particular that were out of power for 7+ days using the heat map capabilities that the health department has in tracking has been noticed that that's where we're seeing this uptake. And, you know, I think that's an important concept to get out there, an idea to get out there for you all, because, you know, as the Energy Committee is going to be doing our part to hold the utilities accountable for how they've pre-staged the event. We're having our informational forum on Thursday. My co-chair and I, the rest of the committee, along with the governor's team, are working on a pretty expansive piece of legislation that will hopefully be taken up in special session sometime in September. But I wanted to get that out there because I think it's important. And, you know, I'm going to be reaching out to the Department of Public Health, looking for statistics from other cities in the state where power was out for the longest to see if any uptick in cases happen there and see what we can do going forward. So I want to thank you for this and hand it back to the mayor.
All right, State Rep David Arcanti Jr., who is the House Chair of the Energy Committee there. You also heard from Governor Ned Lamont and also Danbury Mayor Mark Boughton. What do you think? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You know him, you love him, from the website ctcapitalreport.com and the Capitol Report every Sunday morning at 10 on News 8. Tom Dudchick is with us. Tom, how are you?
Paul, thank you for that kind introduction. Very kind of you. Here in the World Capitol Report headquarters in East Haddam, Connecticut, as you're giving locations of where everyone is.
Well, you know, I was nice because your check cleared, and that's
good. Thank you, Paul. I appreciate that.
Boy, it's been a while. First of all, happy fall, happy upcoming fall, happy late summer to you. Hey,
Well, I know, you know, and I can tell you because the trees are all stressed because we're in this drought. And in my backyard, I don't know about yours, but it looks like fall out there already. And it was still got like a week to go in August.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. Does that mean the trees are stressed?
Does that mean the rake and the plastic bag is going to come out early, or do you have people, do you hire people for that?
No, oh come on, yeah. I'm from Ansonia. We don't hire people. You know, we work ourselves. You know, I'm just going to put the leaf blower and blow it back on my neighbor's lawn.
Hey, boy, what a mess with the state Republican Party and this whole thing with Justin Anderson and Thomas Gilbert. And I've got people and all these pundits on my show saying, you know, J.R. Romano's got to go and this is ridiculous. And what was up with him and what was up with Sue Hatfield? Man,
it's crazy.
Head spinning here. Head
it's
spinning,
crazy.
Tom.
It's crazy. It's crazy. And I think we live in an age of at 2020 where the current occupant of the White House has just basically taught many Republican politicians that, hey, let's move on. Nothing to see here. I'm not going to resign. And, you know, we'll just wait it out. And we'll let the news cycle, which is incredibly fast, as you know, Paul, because you're in on a daily basis, people will forget. And in a month, nobody will even remember. But like, I'm sure the senator from Minnesota, Al Franken, is probably, you know, kind of like thinking, well, I should have waited it out, too. And so that's where we are, Paul. I mean, very, very, very rarely do people do the right thing. They just think they can just settle it out. And as we talked about on our TV program last Sunday, you know, the thoughts should have been with the victim. And that was the first thing that people should have been concerned about. And they should have worried about her. And they should have done the right thing. And a pox on both of their houses of people who are running, number one, using it for political gain and not doing the right thing. And then, you know, the other candidate who obviously was, you know, should hopefully be serving time for what he did to that woman.
Yeah, bad stuff. One more thing on the congressional races. You and I both know that Rosa DeLauro's not going to lose. Joe Courtney's not going to lose. Jim Himes likely won't lose. John Larson's there forever. David Sullivan, any shot in the fifth against Johanna Hayes or not?
Well, yeah, well, certainly I know the Republican Party is spinning the fact that he may have a chance, and he may very well have a chance to make it closer. But as you know, most people think that the president of the United States is going to be a tremendous drag on the ticket in an incredibly blue state and getting bluer. And so, besides J.R. Romano's inability to actually do the right thing in this case, he hasn't had a lot of victories here in the state of Connecticut. When you look at the entire congressional delegation, as you point out, is all Democrat. We have Democrat senators, both them. We have a Democrat governor. Every constitutional office is Democrat in both parts of the House. So, winning is the proof here, and there's not a lot of winning going on.
Like Bill Parcells always says, what does he say, Tom? You are what your record says you are. And he's 100% right.
There you go. Yeah.
Is Trump going to be that much of a drag, do you think, on the Republicans in the state Senate and the state House this coming November?
Well, I do think there will be. I think there will be some Republican pickups, but I think overwhelmingly there will be, Republican losses. The reason I say that those measured comments is because, as you know, most of these districts are so incredibly gerrymandered across the state of Connecticut that they're all safe Democratic districts, or the few that are Republican are pretty much safe Republican districts. There's not a lot of gray area when you look at the districts that could turn over. And Paul, as you know, that was done by design. Both parties look at the map and they carve them up, and they sit there and they draw these squiggly lines encompassing Republican districts, then loop it around back into some more Democratic and so it's really a crazy process, but that's the reason why you don't really see much change.
Coming up also, Tom, we have this whole controversy now, again, another one with the Secretary of the State's office, Denise Maryland. Oh, by the way, you cities and towns, you're going to have to handle all the mailing of ballots. I mean, wow, I don't know about you, Tom. I read that and said, oh, really? And now the town clerks and the registrars are saying, wait a minute, when did this happen? Again, Tom, I say on the show all the time, I don't think people are, a lot of them, are not intrinsically against mail-in voting. There have been states that have been doing it for years, but they seem to have done it in a very careful way, and now, maybe because of the virus, you get this stuff coming out of the Secretary of the State's office. And to me, Tom, I'm not surprised why people are cynical here a little bit.
Well, and you have every reason to be. And let's throw upon that the Postal Service. And listen, these town clerks, they work incredibly hard. They're honorable public servants. The people that work in the polls, the people that work in the town clerk offices have never had to have this volume before. Well, here's a perfect example for you. The town clerk, the registrar of voters in the Ansonia sent out a ballot to my mom, a loyal WICC listener for many, many, many years, a week ahead of the election, the primary, a week ahead. I think it was postmarked, first-class mail, August 2nd. Ample time to get from downtown Ansonia to where she lives in Ansonia. Ample time.
Okay.
Well, she waited for the ballot. She never got it.
Oh.
She voted in person because she's been doing that all her life. The ballot came, I think, like last week.
Seeing now. Oh. I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh. But,
no, you should be laughing. And her comment to me when she told me via a text and sent me a picture of the envelope, she goes, "You think there's going to be a problem in November?"
And this is just
one isolated incident.
Yeah.
And I've heard countless incidents. This one is personal because it's my mom, who worked at the polls all her life in Ansonia. She takes it as her duty, civic duty, to vote, and she doesn't miss elections. And the fact that she waited and waited and waited, and the registrar of voters, I mean, they didn't do anything wrong. They sent it out with ample time to get to her, and here we have it.
Yeah, and Tom, you and I both know, because we've read, you know, people say, well, all these Western states do it. Yeah, but I tell them it took some of these states, Colorado, Washington State, Utah, they've gone through three or four cycles of their general assemblies, their legislatures. Tom, they have finely crafted rules. They have people in separate offices that overlook this thing. I mean, I know we have concerns about COVID and all that, but how do you do this in 2 months?
We're not going to be randomly mailing out ballots, Paul. You know that. We're going to be randomly mailing out the absentee form. And so you still have to go through the process of filling out the form and sending it back, and then they send you back, again, two places where it could fail, then send you back the ballot. So the fact that people say that they're going to be just sending out random ballots to everybody who doesn't even request them, and then the ballot harvesters are going to come in and scoop them up, and they're all going to vote for Joe Biden, you know, that's a little bit of a conspiracy theory, at least as far as Connecticut goes.
Who do we have on the program this Sunday morning at 10, Tom?
Oh, it's going to be an interesting program. Liz Kranowitz, who has been on your air before, and I'm still trying to figure out a good Democrat to come on and be her foil. Maybe perhaps you can give me some suggestion to that. But it is chock full. Maybe we'll have another run at Mark Boughton and John Oliver. What do you think?
He was on today with the governor. I don't know, it was on CTN. The mayor stand side by side with the governor, probably thinking, you know, I should have had your job.
Yes, I think a lot of people probably think that, but guess what? It didn't work out that way.
No. All right, folks, check it out. The Capitol Report, News 8, 10 a.m. Sunday morning. Don't forget the website. Everybody reads it hundreds of times a day, ctcapitalreport.com. Tom Dudchick, a proud son of Ansonia, a proud son of the WICC listener footprint.
Tell your
mom we said hi, will you?
I will do that, Paul. Thanks,
Tom. Appreciate it. Tom Dudchick there. All right. CTCapitalReport.com.